Welcome, welcome, welcome back to Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific? Jim Caruso, I am in yet another country.
Yes, you're in a home country, or at least that's what you call it.
Yeah, so I have come to you in the past several weeks from Singapore, Thailand, Vietnam, the Philippines, Taiwan. It's actually kind of nice to be in my country.
Well, it's nice that you're not on the lam anymore.
Exactly. Jim, we have with us today the founder and CEO of Rhombus Power, Anshuman Roy. Anshu is has been running Rhombus Power since about 2011, I believe. And Rhombus uses AI to predict things happening in the future. So very famously predicted the Russian invasion of Ukraine several months in advance to the day. And so we're gonna dig in to how all that happens. So Anshu, I'm going to ask you the first question. Why, sir, should we care if artificial intelligence can prevent future conflict?
Hey, thank you, Ray. Thank you for having me. And thank you, Jim. Why should we care? Well, we should care because predictions, forecasts, any peek into the future that can reduce the cone of uncertainty that that future brings with it is generally a good thing because it buys us time to make better decisions. It helps us understand, gives us more time to understand what could be the drivers of conflict. It buys us the time to maybe intervene if we still can, and find ways to avoid such conflict. So, you know, that's in summary, that's why we should care, because it can win peace.
So, Andrew, for novices like us, we only know what we read in the papers, and a lot of the AI we hear about has problems with things like hallucinations and giving out bad data, and we're dealing with such critical factors as war and peace, that sort of incorrect information could be really dangerous. How do you keep that from happening?
Through the best of human curation and subject matter expertise applied on top of what artificial intelligence can tell us. The reason why we see hallucinations, as you probably know, is because ChatGPT is simply trying to guess the next word. It's guessing. And in the end, it's just a good guesser, but it's not going to be always right. In our world, which we inhabit, we use the machine to generate the outputs, whether it be threat prediction or whether it be forecasting what it might cost to buy the next F-35 or what might be the availability of aircrafts 5 years down the road, whatever the question might be. We use our system to make such predictions. And then we don't call it a prediction. We just call it a raw output at that point. And then we apply some very sophisticated analysis on top of that to contextualize what we are seeing from the system. And only when it passes through some significant amount of review do we publish such information. So it's just layers and layers of the usual thing, which is apply the checks and balances that are necessary for responsibly generating outputs with AI.
So let's take for those of us, and there are many of us, and just so that people can understand how AI does things, what, you know, most people, when we talk about AI, really don't know what we're talking about. We're just sort of, there's a gonculator, a bunch of things go into the gonculator and they gonculate out outputs. That's basically, you know, the level of understanding, but we hear enough about it so that we know it's more, it's much more than that. So let's take the specific example just of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. What kinds of things do you need to be able to put into the AI so that it can come up with those kinds of things? And why is that better than just the Ukraine analyst sitting at a desk in the CIA or the Pentagon or the State Department giving their best estimates?
Oh, it's not better. It's complementary at best. And but I think what I'll begin with is, you know, how we do it. By all means, there could be other ways to do it. There's no one way to do this. But I think the basic construct will remain the same. You need data, a lot of it, from a variety of sources. So you can fuse it, you can triangulate information. You generally need multiple sources for the same kind of data, just so you are not fooling yourself, or the machine is not fooling itself. And then what is happening is you're observing what's happening on the Earth, and you're observing what's happening in space, you're observing what's happening in the cyber domain, and you're trying to bring it all together in some fashion with the help of artificial intelligence. What does that mean? Well, what it means is that one has to ultimately go back in time and be a good student of history and learn when certain patterns were observed, what kind of events tended to happen. Now, this is not simple to do, but miraculously, we've managed to do it. It only took 7, maybe 8 years to do it. And like everything else, we started very small, and then we took it all the way to cover the entire Earth. So you're fusing data, you're trying to correlate all of these different observations of changes that are happening across all of these different domains, land, air, sea, space, and cyber. And then historically trying to see whether those patterns were seen before, anything close to it. And in some cases, you will find, especially in the case of Russia, you know, we know a couple of things that Putin has done before the Ukraine invasion. Georgia, Syria, Crimea, you know, the list goes on. And the playbook is quite repeatable. And so the machine catches on to it very easily. But it's not easily done by human beings because there's so much to see. And the machine can then see patterns which human beings are not able to see. Because of the computational expanse of this problem. Then subject matter expertise comes in, right? Once it is able to make those connections saying, oh, this pattern looks like it's been seen before, looks like a conflict is about to start, looks like Russia is going to attack. Then the human reasoning and calculation begins, which is with additional models, we are able to figure out how many days to the invasion. And that's a process. That's a process we run, which is, which is again, learning from historical patterns, Russian doctrine, and so on and so forth. Seeing where certain important people show up at what time and so on and so forth, seeing commercial activity pick up, sales of certain kinds of goods such as vodka and so on. And that becomes, there are many, many indicators like that, hundreds of them. You asked the question about the analyst at the desk and you know, I'm not going to say anything new here. The world is an overwhelming place, and data generated in this world is largely overwhelming. But it is almost impossible for any one analyst to be able to see it all. And they can barely have the time to know some of it, interpret some of it, and then be able to provide insights. But there's also an organizational side to this, right? When we talk about an invasion that is imminent, it's not like there's one analyst at a desk thinking about the Russian invasion of Ukraine. They're probably looking at a part of the problem because that's their job description. And there are many such folks who are looking at different parts of the problem. This is a relic of the industrial age, but this is how we divided and conquered the work, right? Now, somebody is responsible for integrating it all. and then figuring out what is the collective insight I'm seeing from all of this. What happens is that's entropy kicks in, noise comes in, right? In the deconstruction and reconstruction of any problem, noise comes in and errors get made. And so there's a, it's not just that it's computationally intensive, it's also that organizations are structured in certain ways that they are unlikely to be able to find effective ways to forecast on time, because it takes time.
It's really interesting. I was an analyst at the bank, and I was an analyst for a time at the State Department. And you're right, the amount of information that comes in is overwhelming sometimes, and also not very timely. So how do you manage information that's new versus not new? And also, how do you manage information that comes in as a means to throw you off track, disinformation?
Yeah. Well, the second piece that you asked is actually the easier part, which is how do you use filters for misinformation and disinformation? And that's actually something we have uniquely developed here at Rhombus because we found it to be a necessity. And so we invented it, and we found that it's really necessary for what we do in terms of forecasting where the world is headed. But actually, there's also a market for it. So it's become a product on its own right now. And so that's a separate thing. But the part of how do you keep track of new data that's coming in versus old data? And I guess you also asked data that's originating for the first time and so on. I think the best way to answer that is imperfectly and iteratively. And so what does that mean? Well, what it means is that if data is being generated for the very first time, there is no way for any system to know anything about it until you have a little bit of you give it some time for it to be able to become similar to something that it's seen before, which it could potentially match. So it's a new kind of sensor, let's say, right? A new sensor is being integrated into our system. The question is, what is that sensor measuring? So there are some methodological tricks here, which we play to perform the modeling at a level where we can actually aggregate all the sensors to a general level of changes, which basically means that I'm not interested in knowing what I'm measuring at the beginning. I just need numbers, and I'm considering everything as a sensor, and I'm trying to correlate. That's sort of how we, you know, that's called phenomenological modeling in physics, and that's all you do. And then you drill down. Okay. And the reason I mentioned this sounds kind of complicated, but the reason that's important to know is any new sensor, therefore, can be plugged into our system. There's a way we have developed to plug it in and give it some amount of time before we can pick up how that contributes to our overall learning of the environment. When we drill into it, new sensors keep coming, new kinds of phones and new kinds of data and, you know, new kinds of apps, and they keep telling you new kinds of things. That's a drill down process that we use to actually then say, if it matters, if the sensor is giving us some pertinent information as determined by the AI model in general, then we drill down automatically and we try to extract what it might be trying to tell us. I'm sorry, I hope it answered your question. I kind of got carried away.
I have many more.
Well, let's start with this. Understanding that, you know, kind of as a baseline, people tend to understand ChatGPT as AI. And you mentioned before that basically this large language model, what it does is it has a whole bunch of information from the internet, and it goes through that to try to guess the next word that you're asking about, right? So, but obviously, in order to do the kinds of predictions that Rhombus is doing, you need other data. You can't just take everything on the internet. So where does all this data come from?
Okay, great question. So it comes from a variety of sources, all commercial and publicly available sources. So this is satellites, multiple kinds of satellites that we access, all commercial. We have access on social media, mainstream media. We have a variety of ad tech related sources. We have lots and lots of socioeconomic data sources, climate related data, trade, sentiments, you know, all of that. And then much of the data that comes in is, there are over 5,000 streams of data coming in into the system. So it gets fused based on what's needed for addressing a particular type of question. And so it all begins with asking the right kinds of questions.
So as computing power gets more powerful, and presumably one day we'll have quantum computers out there, will that improve the quality of the analysis or just the speed with which it's done?
Oh, that's a good question. It'll definitely improve speed, yes. A question of quality. So when you think about artificial intelligence, I really like Judea Pearl's way of describing it. And let me describe that to you. He thinks of a triangle, right? A triangle. And think of three layers in that triangle, okay? The bottom layer is... think of it as correlation, okay? Association, he calls it association. It's the same thing as correlation. So data is being fed into this triangle. The bottom layer is doing association between the data, okay? The next level up is, he calls it intervention, okay? Which means you're intervening and probing into the data to ask what is causing what. Trying to figure that out.
So you can query the system in real time.
Yeah, exactly. And then the third level up is what he calls counterfactuals, which I call imagination. So if you think of these three levels, for any system to have artificial intelligence capability, and he dubs it as weak AI, not strong AI, for even this is weak AI, you need all three. Okay. So now the question is, what is imagination, right? What is counterfactual? Counterfactual is facts that haven't happened, right? What's never happened before. Okay. So that means there is no data for it, right? Okay. So you know what humans are really, really, really good at? Imagination. Limited amount of data, but lots of imagination. You know what machines are very good at? Lots of data, lots of association. Okay. And the middle layer is actually a hybrid between humans and machines right now. Okay. Now, we can get into this debate of whether ChatGPT imagines things or not. Okay. But I think we can probably agree that it doesn't imagine things very well as of yet. Okay. So the question of analysis you asked is actually related to that. It is related to the ability of not just machines and not just the compute side of things, but also the programming, the modeling and programming side of things in a way that humans will direct ultimately, okay? Well, some of that code could be written by artificial intelligence bots and so on, but again, that's our choice. And that is critical for the quality of analysis to improve. That's where I was taking you.
Let's talk about how your predictions are received. Because, you know, I've spent some time in the intelligence world, and you know, as you note, I mean, just because somebody says the computer said this is going to happen, I know that's not what you're saying, but you know, but that's what it feels like, right? And so, if you show up and say, like you recently in February, Rhombas predicted that July would reach a peak of political instability in Bangladesh. Mm-hmm. Now, we all know what happened in Bangladesh in July, right? And then by August, the prime minister was stepping down. So clearly, your prediction was an important prediction. It proved out. But how are things like this received by people who hear about them? Do they believe you? Do they trust the AI? Do they trust your approach? How is it coming across?
Well, I would say it's been a journey from our days in Afghanistan. I don't know if you saw that Raven Sentry article in The Economist. From our days in Afghanistan in 2019 and 20, where we saved many lives because we were able to predict where the Taliban might attack next, and to the point where we are today, which is we're doing things much more at scale, much bigger questions, even than what we were answering in Taliban. You know, there's been a shift in the acceptance of or the posture in general on the customer side, because the customer is also getting more and more educated about what such technology can do and what it can't do. And so broadly speaking, I would say that there is more receptivity, and it's increasing, and more curiosity, more deeper questions being asked to probe the output and to be able to ascertain whether it is in fact reasonable or not. So overall, I think the attitude has gone from complete confusion to, okay, I think I understand where you might be going with this. But I won't say it's an embrace of any sorts, but it's an improvement, surely.
If your system was around, say, during the age of whether you're going to go into Iraq or not, and the analysis, and I would argue the confirmation bias, led us down the wrong path, your system would avoid the confirmation bias, despite the fact you have analysts, but it also would have required more data points than were used in our analysis. Is that a fair description?
It's a fair assessment. Yeah, it's a fair assessment. And we would probably be, I think our system would be collecting a lot more. And more importantly, I think it would be able to see things in a more connected way. That I think is since you've lived in the intelligence world, you probably know the intentional siloing that exists for all very good reasons, having to do with confidentiality or classification or whatnot, but it creates its challenges. And so there's certainly, in this particular instance you talked about, I think there's potential with the right permissions, one could have seen things collectively. Yes.
Now, one thing you did see, because it was one of your early successes, was fentanyl flows coming out of China.
Right.
How were you able to do that, and what difference did it make?
Well, thank you for asking that. We are very proud of that effort. It was called Sable Spear. And what Sable Spear did is it was able to map out all of the actors involved in the illicit trade of fentanyl globally in a geospatial manner, for the very first time, be able to integrate what we were seeing on the surface web, the internet, and the dark web, where all the bad stuff gets traded. But the open web is really the place where it gets marketed. And so when you can fuse the two, you can find some really important nodes in that network, which is extremely global. What difference did it make? It was used, we are told now, in various negotiations with that other country with supplies. And it was It resulted in a 900% increase in the number of entities that the customer was aware of as being involved in this global trade, 900%.
Yeah.
Within 4 months, if I may add.
That's very impressive. Well, as you know, we talk a lot about crisis points in Asia, Taiwan Strait, South China Sea, China-India border, North Korea. So are you looking at those areas and are you seeing anything particularly concerning in the near term?
All the time. We are. That's one of the most important things we do within Ambient, our system, as well as we do work for the U.S. government and at various levels. For this pacing threat, you know, it's very important to recognize how capable they are and how effective they are in their ability to execute. And so capability is one thing, but can you execute or not? America is very capable, but, you know, sometimes execution becomes a challenge in a democratic society. And so it's a very fascinating. I can't get into the details of all the things we do, but I would say from a commercial side, we are definitely able to connect the dots in ways that we are able to predict forecast their military moves, their non-military moves, their disinformation campaigns, their space maneuvers, and be able to make sense out of that to understand where they might be headed. And so that's, we have 2027 on our minds, and so we are always watching, and we try to figure out how much of what they are doing is headed in that direction all the time.
One of our earlier episodes, of course, was with Admiral Davidson, who made the unintentionally made the year 2027 very, very famous. So as you're talking about China, of course, one of the things that we would be concerned that they would do is develop the kind of capability that you have now, right? So,
sure.
You know, what is, if we don't stay on top of this, what is the possibility that our adversaries may very soon be able to predict our movements, or are they already able to predict our movements?
Yeah, it's one of those things that's hard to know unless you're behind the firewall, right? So it's on the other side of the firewall. So it's I guess we can just say this, that I think it's a capability that we best assume they have.
Well, that's not terrifying at all.
You know, one thing that keeps coming to mind is that humans are unpredictable.
Yeah.
And in the run-up to Ukraine, the arguments that Putin would never do this, it's self-destructive, as it turned out to be, actually. So it went against logic. But you're not using logic, you're using information that indicates a direction. Is that a way to think about it?
So the way I think about it, Jim, is we are using scientific methodology on the observations. The world is our experimental sort of bench. Think of it that way. And there are many experiments going on all the time. No, we're not conducting them. People are doing it. And we're observing, you know, militaries are moving and people are migrating and all of that stuff is happening. And what we are doing is we're taking those data points and we're asking, can we understand this phenomenon better? Well, how did Newton figure out force equals mass times acceleration? He did some experiments systematically, got some data, found a correlation between force and acceleration. It was not perfectly linear, but he drew a line through it, right? And that became force equals mass times acceleration. Today, we call it a law, Newton's first law. Well, why do we call it a law? Because it's valid well beyond the bounds of what the experiments were performed for. It seems to work everywhere. Okay. Now, let me bring you to what we do. It all begins with correlation. Correlation, when we apply logic, as you said, when you apply logical reasoning on top of what we're observing as correlations, which you can think of as processed outputs, then we can get to causation. For that, we need subject matter expertise. We have now ended up building what we call at least semi-causal models, right? They're not perfectly causal. We don't understand the minds of these people. Of course, we don't. We're not sitting inside them, so it's impossible to know. But at least we can get to semi-causal models where we are sort of sitting somewhere between correlation and causality and continuously trying to figure out if we can get toward causality. That's what these things are built up for. Now, that's very powerful. And so, yes, most computation in AI is sitting at the level of correlation only. We come in on top of that and say, can we actually really make sense from a causal perspective? A is not just correlated with B, A causes B. That kind of a thing.
So one of the analogies I know that you've used before is that of the butterfly effect. Yeah. And when we talk about the butterfly effect, those causalities aren't always very clear. So, you know, we're saying that the butterfly is flapping its wings over here and it has these effects over here. We don't necessarily see how it all works. Why is the butterfly effect important to the way that you look at how artificial intelligence can help us predict the future?
So from our vantage point, right, you know, it's this. Bangladesh went through an instability. We all know that. Okay, well, it's one thing to be able to say that the instability happened. Could anyone have predicted it? Yes, we predicted it. Why were we able to predict it? Well, it's because we look at as much as we can. We look at 1,000 different variables on just one country, including climate, which builds up slowly. The effects build up very slowly. And there is socioeconomic, financial, all of that stuff, right? So inflation is going up, and economy is not doing well, and, you know, people are generally grossly unhappy, and the climate's not helping at all. And so the tinder keeps building up more and more. And until it gets to a point where a reservation quota becomes an issue, an issue that has been around for decades. So this is a classic multi-timescale problem, as we engineers would call it. You have to account for all of those timescales. So okay, so we can predict it. Now, here's the point, right? Where does that butterfly effect come in? So the fact that one domino fell, that migrants from Bangladesh are sitting in countries all over the world, right? They go to make a living in Europe, or in the Middle East, and wherever. And in every country that they go, whether it be France or Italy or wherever, you're a Bangladeshi chef in some restaurant, and now your country just shut down its internet. You can't send money back home. You're going to be unhappy. And so these effects transmit very fast. And suddenly you see there are protests happening in other parts of the world. Okay, so the one thing happening in one place can cause, it's again, a slowly building effect in this case, suddenly became an issue when the tinder built up enough and one match could literally create this effect. Something similar happened with Arab Spring, by the way. Before that, young man lit himself up in Egypt, and that fruit seller in Tunisia lit himself up. 18 months ago, there was a fire in Ukraine, right? Remember? And then before that, and so Ukraine being the largest supplier of wheat to the region, well, that means prices would go up. Well, there's Russia. There was a fire in Russia too. It was a really bad year. It was a really dry year. Some of it is attributable to climate change, not all of it. It's also the El Niño, El Niña cycle. But anyway, then what happens? Well, why didn't Egypt produce its own wheat? Well, they produced, didn't produce a whole lot, but it was also a very bad year because the River Nile was running very low because it's a reservoir. The lake, Lake Victoria, which supplies, was at a historical low. Why is that? Because of historically low rainfall in South Sudan and all of those regions south of Egypt.
So essentially, I'm just trying to to contextualize it. So basically what you're saying is that probably human analysts are not able to sort of pull all of these threads together and come up with something that says this could produce the Arab Spring, but AI can help you do that.
AI can help you recognize that those patterns are being observed. The collection of those patterns are being observed to the point where the butterfly effect can actually kick in. This is when a young man lights himself up and the tinder is really there and it'll just explode.
So the problem we used to have when we're trying to do analysis like this is how to give the right weightings to these various factors.
Yeah, yeah. Right? And we've struggled with that too, Jim. We've struggled with that too. And what we did is we inverted the problem. Instead of us giving the weights, what we did was we let the machine figure out the weights by just giving it what happened and what was observed. And because computation has become so powerful now, that's why neural nets were created and so on, that those weights can now get ascertained in ways that are not just one particular factor to the event at hand, instability, let's say, but it's also combinations of factors. To the point, by the way, that it becomes its own mess because you can't understand why the machine is telling you what it's saying. And then you need, that's an art form to actually extract why you're seeing what you're seeing.
Well, you are sitting here talking to us and you have a University of Michigan shirt on and it says chemical engineering on it. You have your PhD in chemical engineering or some form of that. Yeah. How does a chemical engineer end up doing this?
Oh, that's a good question. So I would say random walk. Perhaps. And
so your machine couldn't have predicted this.
Probably not. I had never thought I would be doing something like this. But after graduating from Michigan, I went to Santa Barbara. I worked with a Nobel laureate there, Alan Heger, who taught me a lot about life, but mostly he taught me that I could do anything I wanted to, which made it terribly confusing, frankly, because I wanted to do a lot of things. And to the point that I actually quit academia 4 years later, and I decided to start Rhombus Power. And so for 6 years, at that point, I invented a neutron detector, which got commercialized in Fukushima, and then met up with DIU. And DIU really exposed me to a lot of these questions.
Right. And problems. DIU is the Defense Innovation Unit.
That's right, Defense Innovation Unit, and they opened the door to national security problems for us, and this is when the dots connected in hindsight, because my entire PhD is based on modeling complex phenomena, and computing and understanding instabilities. My PhD thesis was titled "Instabilities and Turbulence in Viscoelastic Fluids." Now, that's not of the world, but instabilities and turbulence in the world is not very different, except you don't know the governing equations, that's all. And that's why you need a correlative set of equations. And that's when we realized that machine learning could really help, because what it's actually generating is a set of not necessarily governing equations, but what are called constitutive models. It's actually generating those. And so I came from that world, and so it was sort of easy for me to map it once I got exposed to what are the problems that need to be solved for tomorrow, not today, but let's focus on tomorrow. so we can have a competitive edge, both as a company and as a country.
Well, sir, I certainly hope that that comes to pass. Obviously, Jim and I have spent a long time, many decades between us in, you know, concerned about the security of our country. And so we certainly hope that your work is successful, and that we certainly do it better and faster than those other guys. So thank you for joining us today. It's been a pleasure, and we hope that we'll have you on again sometime soon.
Thank you, Ray, and thank you, Jim. It was a real pleasure. Thank you.
Well, Jim, that was really something. Now, I wanted to do this off the top, but I should go ahead and put in this disclaimer. I have a contractual relationship with Rhombus Power. I'm a consultant for them. So I do have a relationship with Anshu and a financial relationship with Anshu. Hopefully that didn't affect the quality of my questions. Of course, my standard is pretty low there already, but...
Well, look, even if your questions weren't as pitch perfect as usual, it was a really interesting discussion. Look, AI is the flavor, right? And yep, apparently will be for a long time.
Yeah.
And Andrew seems to be on the cutting edge of using it in a way that's immediately useful, as opposed to a lot of the AI products we see out there, which are, we're still trying to figure out, like early internet, how are we going to use this tool?
Yeah.
He's using it.
Yeah, I fairly recently have this this relationship with Rhombus, and I've been fascinated the whole time. Like, you know, obviously it takes a long time to build up the algorithms and the data and all of the things you need in order to be able to do what they're doing in all the places that they're doing it. But I think it is very helpful to be able to understand why AI is important. You know, basically that you can use, essentially, you know, just to keep it simple, you can use computers and algorithms in order to be able to detect trends and anomalies as he mentioned, bring in all of those various data streams from all these different disciplines that we don't usually think of as being together in one place. You know, when I worked in and around intelligence, I can tell you, I didn't think about what the climate patterns were going to be in Bangladesh in the summer of 2000. You know, those were not things that I would sort of look at the disciplines that I specialized in, and those were where I would concentrate my attention. So, you know, what you're doing is you're basically vastly increasing the number of inputs that you're getting and using the AI to sort through all that and figure out what's really important there.
I guess my problem remains that you can take all those inputs and you'll have a situation like you said in Egypt, where a guy sets himself on fire, all hell breaks loose. Or you have a situation like in Venezuela elections now, where the election is stolen, but Maduro seems to have consolidated his power through, I guess, by being so brutal.
Yeah.
So I don't know how the algorithm can guess how much brutality is sufficient to crush the uprising.
Yeah. Well, I think that's why the Bangladesh
thing is. The guess comes in.
It's also where the Bangladesh example is useful, because the stolen election or the suspected stolen election happened in December, I believe, in Bangladesh. But that was not when the instability really began. And it wasn't until July, with this whole question about quotas for government jobs, which, again, you know, who knows that that's going to come to the surface and be the sort of the match that lights the tinder. And somehow the AI was able to assist Rhombus in making that particular projection. So it is really fascinating. And one suspects it's only going to get better, because they will continue to fine tune and get more and more different kinds of data and the right kinds of data. So.
Yeah. It's a great new tool. Speaking of tools, you have a story for us?
Are you calling me a tool? Is that the... Okay.
I'm just going on.
Nice transition.
That's a segue, Ray.
Oh, it's a segue. Oh, yes, you're a trained professional. Okay. So I'm going to talk about traffic in Vietnam. And I've talked about this once before because I think I may have told you about the motorbike accident once.
Oh, yes.
Traffic is, in Vietnam is legendary. And one of the things that makes traffic so interesting in Vietnam is most things are on two wheels. So most people are getting around now on motorbikes. And what that means is, well, several things. One is that there is a tremendous number of vehicles on the street at any given time. You know, a car takes up this much space, motorbike takes up a fraction of that. And so you can fit a lot of motorbikes. And so, you know, that means that things like crossing the street are people make videos about how to cross the street in Vietnam. And essentially the idea is you just do it. You just walk steadily out into traffic and it will go around you and it will be fine probably. But the other thing that it means is that people can put almost anything on a motorbike. And, you know, we have seen, you know, people have been there and, you know, you've seen a person driving on a motorbike with like three dead pig carcasses on it, or a refrigerator, or like this huge, you know, or a family of five, you know, on a motorbike, on a single motorbike. And the one that really sticks with me is I was out one day driving around with the Marine attaché, all of a sudden we drive by this guy and he has like 30 live ducks on his motorbike. So he has like tied them to the back, you know, and he's got them sitting on the little floorboard at the base of the motorbike. And they're like sitting in a basket in front, looking around. And it was the most Vietnam thing ever to have this guy with all these live ducks. And, you know, like they weren't in a cage. They were just like, you know, all over the motorbike. But it was so emblematic of what things look like when it comes to traffic in Vietnam.
You know, it reminds me of a joke, Ray.
Okay.
A guy has 30 penguins at his house and he can't deal with them anymore. So he asks his assistant, can you take the 30 penguins and take them to the zoo? So the guy says, okay, loads them on the bus. Off they go. The next day, guy comes in and they're the penguins again, getting on the bus again. He says, I thought I told you to take him to the zoo. He said, yeah, I did. And they liked it so much, today I'm taking him to the circus.
Well, I think, I don't know. Ian, is that called a dad joke?
I think it is.
It is now. All right. Well, thanks, Dad. So I want to thank our audience for sticking with us. I want to thank Dad for throwing in that joke at the end. I want to thank our producer, Ian, for putting all this together. And I want to invite everyone to, again, if you're watching this on YouTube, remember, we also have a podcast. So you can always download it on your Apple Podcasts or Spotify, your favorite streaming service. And that way you can listen to us when you're on the treadmill, if you want to know more about how to predict the future with AI during your time on the Peloton. So for Ian and Dad, this is Ray, and thanks for joining us for Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific?